You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, we tend to take it for granted, but refrigeration has shaped human history and culture in profound ways.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Marquette professor suspended after a controversial blog post. A Minnesota judge recommended against a proposed natural gas plant in Superior, and Attorney General Brad Schimel says he doesn't want to get Wisconsin involved in a lawsuit against opioid makers.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the Supreme Court ruling today that John McAdams, a political science professor at Marquette, was improperly suspended by the university for a blog post that he had made some years ago. Supporters are calling this a victory for academic freedom. Can you give us the background of the case here?
Sure. So McAdams was a political science professor. He was also a conservative blogger. And part of, you know, academic freedom is an important value of many universities, and the idea is that academics need the ability to say what they think and, you know, express what their research finds without being worried about sanction if it makes someone uncomfortable or whatever. So this is the sort of the principle, and whereas these things often do, it becomes more complicated is when you start to look at the actual specifics of the case. So he had written this a conservative student's complaint about his philosophy instructor, who was a graduate student, and said that the instructor wouldn't allow him to or students to discuss their opposition to gay marriage in class. The student had secretly, like, made a recording of that conversation, and so McAdams posted that recording. He named the graduate student. It blew up into a thing, you know, in conservative circles. It was a viral post, and as a result, the graduate student got a bunch of responses. She said she got death threats as a result, and so the suspension, from Marquette's point of view, was about his behavior toward that graduate student as opposed to his views on the issue as such. But today the Supreme Court said nope. He was entitled to post what he wanted to post on his blog.
So McAdams' attorneys at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty made the case sort of about terms of his employment rather than his viewpoints. And it sounds like Marquette wasn't too happy with this ruling.
Yeah, well, I mean, right. So this is Marquette's point of view, is that this was because he kind of like acted like a jerk toward this student. And I think, you know, there's nothing that we can all agree on anymore, I suppose, but it seems like we should all be able to agree that he kind of acted like a jerk toward this graduate student. He was given the opportunity to write a private apology and get his job back, and he declined to do that. I think that you can say maybe he should have known or foreseen that there could be this blowback from making this post. But from his point of view, this is his expression. He was using his First Amendment rights within the terms of his contract to express his views on this blog, and so this is the finding, is that he never should have been suspended for it.
And the court came down with what I believe was a 4-2 ruling, with more conservative justices ruling in favor of McAdams, but the two liberal justices on the court dissenting. What did those justices have to say?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. A big part of the dissent focused on the fact that Marquette is a private university. And so it kind of makes sense that a private institution would have more latitude to limit speech than a public university might, though in this case that was not the winning argument. But it's interesting that there were some groups that were maybe traditionally more conservative groups who weighed in on the side of the university, saying that, look, this is a private institution, they can regulate it how they want. The winning argument in this case from the Wisconsin Institute for Liberty, Law and Liberty, was that, they could regulate, as a private entity, they could regulate his speech if they wanted to, but he was under the terms of his existing contract that he had, said that he had all, he had the freedom to say what he wanted and it wouldn't be interfered with.
We're talking right now with Rob Menser. He is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And we're talking about some of the top news stories in Wisconsin this week. And I want to move on to another legal story, Rob. This is a court ruling in Minnesota, but huge impact here in Wisconsin. It has to do with a proposed $700 million natural gas power plant in Superior. What was going on here, and what was the judge weighing in on?
Yeah, this is big news for the northwest part of the state, although maybe not so well known outside of that Superior area, or at least not so well known to me. But this is an interesting story that came down this earlier this week when a municipal judge ruled on an administrative proceeding, making the recommendation that that the Minnesota Public Service Commission should not allow this partnership of Minnesota Power and the Wisconsin company Dairyland Power to build this giant facility. This judge said that they have not demonstrated that the new plant was needed and reasonable.
And the thing that was interesting about this is I tend to think of a judge's ruling as, okay, this is the word, or it goes to an appeals court, another judge takes care of it. But it sounded like the results of this were not necessarily binding, and this power plant could still happen.
Right. I mean, well, it's so complicated. I mean, there is a public utility, and so there are all these, it's heavily, heavily regulated. But yeah, this was not like a trial or even a civil lawsuit, but an administrative proceeding. So this is a non-binding recommendation. The on the Minnesota side, the regulators will take up the question of sort of permissions this fall. In Wisconsin, the forms haven't even been filed, so the Wisconsin Public Service Commission will have to, it'll go later than that, likely. But for a project this giant, $700 million facility, it's a long process to go through this, and it doesn't determine that it can't happen, but it's definitely a loss for the power companies.
And what's also interesting, kind of like the last story that we talked about, it seems like there are sort of, advocates on both sides of this. On one hand, I mean, this was going to be a plant that was going to do natural gas sort of as, a backup to renewable energy, but it was going to be in replacement of a coal plant. And it seems like there are arguments to be made on all kinds of sides here. I mean, what kind of reaction are you hearing to this so far?
Right, no, that's exactly so, and it really is interesting. Right, this is a natural gas-powered plant. It's not a coal plant, but for environmental groups, they point out that natural gas is still a fossil fuel. So the power companies argue that that building this type of plant, replacing a coal plant, makes it easier for them to transition to solar or wind energy or other renewable energies in the future. This is part of that transition. The environmental groups say, just go ahead and build the renewable energy plants. Then, if they say sort of cut out this middle this transitional step, the argument in favor is like jobs. Also, that this type of energy is maybe preferable to coal. The argument against, and most of the environmental groups seem to come down against this.
And considering this is the legal week here on the Wisconsin News Roundup, I want to ask about one more story. Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel revealed that he is joining other states in an investigation of opioid manufacturers. But this week he says he will not join a multi-state lawsuit against those drug makers. What's his reasoning there?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, in short, right, Wisconsin is part of this investigative push, and they've subpoenaed records for these opioid manufacturers. Schimmel says that his reasoning is that that joining the lawsuit at this point would make it harder for that investigation to proceed. Earlier this year, there was a wave of, Wisconsin counties, local governments that signed on to these big lawsuits saying that arguing that opioid manufacturers either recklessly or willfully ignored evidence about how dangerous and addictive the products were. So the model for this is like big lawsuits against tobacco companies, which eventually did lead to huge payouts to states. Wisconsin still uses funds to fund smoking cessation programs. And Schimmel is not like, it sounded like his comments weren't like fully against the whole premise of this, but more like tactical, that that at this stage in the process they're trying to get these get this investigation done, and who knows, maybe some of those documents could be useful in a lawsuit in the future.
And Rob, briefly before we wrap up, I want to ask you one more thing. Why are Harley riders getting together in Prague this weekend?
Hey, why not, right? it's the Harley Festival. It's the 115th anniversary celebration is going on in Prague, and some of my colleagues from the Journal Sentinel have some fun photos and videos making me jealous of their travel. And the reason is, it turns out Prague is the site of the world's oldest Harley-Davidson Riders Club.
Huh, who knew?
It is in its 90th year.
What a celebration. Well, that's going to be something to watch for, and we'll have to leave it there. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Rob Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He joins us each week for our state news roundup. Even in the dog days of summer, we may not pay much attention to how different life would be without refrigeration. But it turns out that when humans developed ways to cool things thousands of years ago, it set the stage for many of our most important discoveries and advances.
Helen Pevitt is curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London, and she's the author of the new book, Refrigerator, The Story of Cool in the Kitchen. Helen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to meet you, Judith.
So do we know when people first started trying to keep things cool?
It's kind of hard to say, but I'm guessing if you've had ice around, people were probably using it. So it's probably if you were in a cold area, so maybe Canada, Alaska, northern Russia, if you had ice around, then people are going to have been using it maybe to preserve what they've grown or caught locally. So it's, even though it's not recorded, people tend to think they've been using it for thousands of years.
And what were some of the earliest techniques? You mentioned ice, but you know that's not available to a lot of people in the world. What were some of the earliest techniques that were used that might have been used in warmer climates?
Yeah, people were quite cunning. So you could even produce ice in the desert, which sounds counterintuitive. The Persians, ancient Persians, built great big massive walls even in the middle of the desert. And what they would do is put vessels behind the walls in the shadow, and at night time they'd put something inside that. So they'd fill outside the vessel with water, and the evaporation would evaporate the water and leave ice behind. So even in the middle of the desert, you could produce a little bit of ice.
And when would what we might think of as modern refrigeration first become available?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. We've sort of got a taste ice and for cooling things, and that really came from you in America, I think. Frederick Tudor, Ice King, started a trade in ice and cold ice in the early 19th century, and he was really the first one to see that there was a real value to selling ice, not just to cool your food and drink, but actually to use in food and drink to eat. So from then, really, it's really taken off. At some point in the mid-19th century, there's so much demand for ice, they actually couldn't meet that demand anymore. You couldn't just harvest it naturally from American lakes, or in Britain you might harvest little scrappy bits from ponds over here. We didn't generate as much here. You had to look elsewhere. So they started looking to new steam-powered machinery, really, to produce ice in massive quantities. So from, I guess, mid-19th century, early Victorian period, that's when they start making these whacking great machines, refrigeration machines, ice-making machines that produce ice on a massive scale.
It seems like refrigeration has had the potential to make us healthier for all of the different foods that we're able to access, keeping it cool, presumably safe. Does what seems to be kind of common sense, does that actually bear out?
Yeah, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about this. I think it probably does. It's sort of like a food hub, isn't it? You can almost hold the whole world in your fridge, if you want, in your kitchen. So it's given us unprecedented access to all sorts of different types of foods, fresh fruit, anytime you want it. So that's got to be a good thing in some ways. But, of course, hidden behind that is all the food miles, all this stuff is traveling. But in many ways, I suppose food's probably safer than it ever has been. It's kept cool pretty reliably all the way through that cold chain until it gets to us. So in some ways, I think that's probably true. Our food is probably safer than it ever has been. I suppose the downside of that is you kind of lose, I kind of feel that you've lost, or many of us have lost the sense of what the tacit knowledge we used to have about what is fresh. I don't always know if stuff I'm keeping in there is okay to still use or if I should be chucking it away. I also think I'll probably rely on convenience foods more than I would do. Maybe I cook less and maybe I produce more food waste. So I guess there's two things going on there. In some ways it's making it more healthy and more reliable for us, but, you know, there's a downside. Like everything, like every technology, there's a bit of a downside as well.
We're talking with Helen Pevitt. She's curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London, and we're talking about refrigeration and the impact it's had on human development. And Helen, speaking of health, refrigeration is also a really important part of modern medicine. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, I haven't, until I started researching for the book, I haven't even thought about it, but most of the vaccines, and I suppose even more crucially, blood supplies that get that have to travel around the world, not just not around our countries, but also to some more remote places where maybe there's less of a power supply, they have to be kept at the right temperature. And once that temperature's exceeded, you can't use them anymore. So keeping them at a low temperature is crucial. So I hadn't realized, I hadn't appreciated that things like any of the common vaccines we use today, HIV virus vaccine or any of the blood supplies, do have to be kept so cold.
And so that is interesting because you think of, say, those vaccines being taken to remote places in different countries where they are desperately needed, but where there might not be even reliable electricity. So what kind of refrigeration is possible in those pretty extreme conditions?
Really interesting. There have been some quite nifty gadgets that actually are sort of going back to old types of technology. So all the ice boxes we used to have in our home really started off in America, big insulated ice boxes that just kept things cool, not by extracting heat like our refrigerators do, but just by insulating against the outside temperature, a bit like a lunchbox, I suppose. All of those technologies start coming back into play. So in really remote places, they've started making quite sophisticated ice boxes that actually keep vaccines cold for maybe 3-4 days so you can get them to where they need to be. And you can also get solar-powered ones as well. So we're kind of almost looking back to an older type of technology in the 21st century to keep vaccines cold enough to get them around the world.
And I hadn't thought much about it until reading your book, but all kinds of science depends on the ability to cool things. You mentioned space exploration and what also you call the world's largest and most famous science experiment, the Large Hadron Collider that found the Higgs particle. How does refrigeration make those two things possible?
Yeah, that's I suppose it is, isn't it? The biggest science experiment in the world, and this has been a big one made since. But the way that works is it has to keep the protons running around the great giant underground ring. I think it's about 27 kilometres long, this little ring that's running underneath CERN in Switzerland, to keep those protons on track and to keep on that search for particles they found like the Higgs, and also they're still searching for dark matter. You need to keep the circuit really, really cool. It's working by using powerful superconducting magnets, and they have to be super cool to just above absolute zero to work properly, which is colder than outer space. So, yeah, even within things like that, refrigeration is crucial to the success of those experiments.
And then also for people doing spacewalks, refrigeration is important.
Yeah, the thing about outer space is that obviously you can't convect your heat away. So any astronauts going out on a spacewalk, they are at the mercy of whether or not they're in the sunshine or in the shade. So you can alternate between freezing and overheating and boiling. So it's absolutely vital that what those astronauts do is underneath their main suit, they wear a sort of cooled liquid undergarment, which helps regulate their temperature. It's regulating between the hot and cold.
Wow, that's just fascinating. And like I said, nothing that I had thought about before reading your book. Well, we've talked a lot about the many positives to refrigeration. Are there negatives in refrigeration being such a prominent part of modern human day life?
I think it's got to be. Imagine if the power went down. We've seen when we've had power cuts before. You think about Hurricane Katrina, those unforgettable images of all the abandoned fridges left in the aftermath, just unusable because the power's gone down and they've lost that access to that cold, reliable food supply. The minute the power goes down, I think we're in trouble. We've become so reliant on it and on the refrigerated cold chain all the way along. I think we'd be absolutely lost without it. It would be complete chaos if we suddenly found tomorrow we couldn't use it anymore. So we're super over-reliant on it, and I can't see that doing anything but increase.
Well, and also I'm wondering about environmental impact. Just that many appliances running worldwide, but also I'm sure that the technology is advanced, but I'm sure there's still a footprint to having just a simple home refrigerator.
Yeah, big footprints. There have been some real positives. So we've seen them become more environmentally efficient and more eco-efficient, and they use far less energy than they used to, and they've got safer refrigerants. But the downside is that we tend to be using bigger machines, and, of course, as other parts of the world get access to refrigeration and all the advantages it brings, safe food, freedom from having to go and shop every day, and all the advantages come with that downside. But actually, yeah, more and more of us are relying on using them. So, yeah, mixed blessing again.
Well, and as we wrap up, Helen, are there any exciting developments in refrigeration that you're seeing coming over the horizon?
Oh, wow. Do you know, for the last 10 years, I've been told that the next exciting development will be smart fridges, but I don't think that's where the real developments are going to be. I think we're going to see real changes in how they actually are powered. So I think we're going to see a generation of things like magnetic refrigerators, which move away from the whole engine compressor powered refrigeration system and use slightly savvier ways of cooling things inside.
Well, Helen, thank you so much. This was very interesting.
Judith, nice to talk to you today.
Helen Pevitt is curator of consumer technology at the Science Museum in London. She joined us to talk about her new book, Refrigerator: The Story of Cool in the Kitchen. If you celebrated 4th of July this week, you probably did so with some time-honored favorites, parades, hot dogs, maybe watching fireworks. The holiday has taken on a familiar shape over the years, but Americans haven't always celebrated this way.
Our next guest recently wrote about how the South celebrated Independence Day in the years right after the Civil War in a piece for The Atlantic titled When the 4th of July Was a Black Holiday.
Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts are professors of history at California State University, Fresno, and co-authors of the new book, Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. Blaine, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having us.
And Ethan, great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here.
Now, Blaine, what were 4th of July celebrations like in the South before the Civil War?
Well, before the Civil War, 4th of July celebrations in the South would have looked a lot like 4th of July celebrations in the North, with white Americans, white Southerners, celebrating by taking a day off from their labors, enjoying barbecues, listening to recitations of the Declaration of Independence, and generally kind of reflecting on what the day meant to Americans.
And what did it mean to Americans? What were the main themes of 4th of July before that horrific Civil War?
Well, most communities did recite the Declaration of Independence, and so there was a kind of emphasis on that second paragraph in particular. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the South, these were sentiments that people talked about. As we get closer and closer to the Civil War, however, many white Southerners were more interested in the parts of the Declaration of Independence that emphasized the right to self-government. As they see themselves really starting to fight against a federal government that was opposed to the spread of slavery throughout the United States, they start to draw parallels between their position fighting an overbearing federal government and the position of the colonists who had been fighting a tyrannical British monarchy.
And Ethan, you two open your piece with a quote from Frederick Douglass talking in 1852, so about a decade before the Civil War. He's talking about slavery and the 4th of July specifically. What did the holiday represent for slaves at the time?
Well, for both slaves and for free African Americans, Douglass, by that point, he'd been born a slave, but he had escaped to the North. The holiday was one that they used, particularly free blacks, used to underscore the hypocrisy of the situation in the United States, the hypocrisy of crafting a Declaration of Independence that calls all men created equal, but nonetheless having an institution like slavery where millions of people were enslaved and where hundreds of thousands of more free blacks were treated as second-class citizens. So folks like Douglass, fellow abolitionists in the North, including William Lloyd Garrison, a white abolitionist who very famously burned the Constitution in 1854 on the 4th of July, they often used the holiday as a time to point out this hypocrisy, to point out the gap between the realities of life for African Americans and this soaring sort of rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence. And so that's what Douglass was doing in 1852 when he gives his address. And he gives his address not on July 4th, but on the 5th of July, the day after the 4th of July, which was a day that Northern African Americans like Douglass, he gives his address in Rochester, New York. They often chose to mark the holiday on the 5th. One reason is sort of for a practical purposes. When whites, North, South, East, and West celebrated the holiday, they often did it the way people do today, and that is they drank lots of alcohol. And it was a way to, by celebrating it on the 5th or marking it on the 5th, African Americans could avoid drunken white revelers who might target them. But also they chose us the day after the 4th to underscore this hypocrisy.
Hmm. But they were celebrating on July 5th, it sounds like. So for the African Americans, what were they celebrating?
I think it's complicated. Certainly for abolitionists like Douglass and Garrison, they were critiquing the nation. They were using it as a moment to critique the nation. But more generally, there were plenty of African Americans, both free and enslaved, who enjoyed a holiday, enjoyed celebrating. In the South, many slave owners gave the enslaved that they owned the 4th of July off, allowed them not to work that day, permitted them not to work that day. And so they would celebrate that moment of freedom, the moment to have a little bit of rest. But also they did look to the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, and they saw those ideals as something they wanted to force the nation to live up to.
And Blaine, that celebration on the 5th eventually shifted, and African Americans started to reclaim the 4th of July. What triggered that change?
Well, of course, the biggest change was that the Confederacy lost the Civil War and the Union, or the United States, won. And this, of course, meant that slaves were free. And so they believed that one of the best ways to mark and celebrate their newfound freedom was to really claim Independence Day as their own. And you see this happening throughout the South as soon as the Civil War is over in the spring of 1865. That first 4th of July, newly emancipated slaves claim that day as their own. And you have big celebrations in many major southern cities with thousands of revelers. A lot of freed slaves came from the countryside. They would leave plantations and go into cities. And once in these cities, they had these gigantic celebrations, and you would have orators on stage reading the Emancipation Proclamation, reading the Declaration of Independence, and really emphasizing that second paragraph that we referenced a minute ago. Also reading the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, the 14th Amendment, which granted citizenship to newly freed slaves, and then ultimately the 15th Amendment, which gave voting rights to black men. So they took this day that had always been a day of freedom and liberty for white Americans and said, now it's our day for freedom and liberty.
I can only imagine all of those ways that you just said that they marked the holiday. Those are all anathema to the Confederate citizens who had just lost this war. Very raw emotions. Ethan, what were white people in the former Confederacy doing while the African Americans were celebrating?
Well, they were sitting out the holiday, for one. They'd celebrated with great gusto up until 1861. In places like Charleston, South Carolina, which is the focus of our book, they abruptly stop in 1861 and don't celebrate it. White Southerners don't celebrate it thereafter. Former Confederates also were angry and tried to stop, in many cases, unsuccessfully for a while, tried to stop black celebrations of the 4th. They, in Charleston, they tried to put the very first one in July 4th, 1865, just months after the Civil War had come to a close. They tried to force the Union Army that's there in Charleston to shut down the Black 4th, but the Union Army refused to do that. Thereafter, for at least a decade in most places in the South, white Southerners could do little beyond complain in their journals, write nasty, often racist articles about 4th of July celebrations in white newspapers. But because they lacked political power during Reconstruction, they really couldn't put these couldn't stop black 4th of July celebrations.
We're talking with Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts. They're historians and authors of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. And we're talking about when African Americans really claimed the 4th of July as their own. And I want to talk more about those celebrations. They were called, is it Tullaloos?
Yes. So in Charleston, the 4th of July celebration became known as Tullaloo. So that is a name that applies specifically only to the celebration there. And the name Tullaloo came from a dance. So the freed men and women in Charleston on the 4th of July often gathered down at the Battery. And if your listeners are familiar with Charleston, this is at the base of the city peninsula. And there's a garden there called White Point Garden. So the freed men and women would gather in White Point Garden and dance the Tullaloo. And the Tullaloo was a ring dance that involved 12 men and 12 women. And a woman would go into the middle of the circle while the group around her sang and clapped. And they would say, go hunt your lover, Tullaloo. Go find your lover, Tullaloo. And this was a significant moment in these celebrations. There were a couple of things going on. One thing that was happening is that these freedmen and women were kind of subtly mocking the courtship rituals of their former masters. The other thing that was happening, I would argue, is that they were also very much celebrating their own freedom, particularly their newfound freedom to choose and marry their own romantic partners. Mm-hmm. So the Tullaloo became very important in Charleston, and we have newspaper accounts that talk about how there might be 50 groups in Charleston at White Point Garden dancing the Tullaloo from 8 a.m. in the morning until after midnight on the 4th of July.
So the Tullaloo was first danced in 1876, so a decade after this tradition had been going on. But because it was such a popular ring dance, in a couple years afterwards, it becomes shorthand for the holiday itself. And well into the 1880s and 1890s, they would refer to black Charlestonians' 4th of July as the Tullaloo. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like women were really central to these celebrations. Was it also a way for them to really step out and be leaders in their community?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the striking things about that Tullaloo dance that Blaine was just describing is that women play a central role in it. And, you know, this is a period when women, African American or white, don't have a big public presence. And even in public ceremonies like 4th of July celebrations, there's not that much space made for African American women to participate. They are not the ones who would gather and give orations and recite the Declaration of Independence, recite the Emancipation Proclamation. They were rarely, on occasion they were, but they were rarely those who were leading the parades that were held on the 4th of July. So the Tullaloo, we think, is one of these remarkable moments where women do have a big role.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts. They're professors of history at Cal State Fresno, and we're talking about their research that stems from their new book, Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy. It's about a time when Black Southerners used Independence Day to celebrate the end of slavery.
And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Have you heard of this time in American history? What do you think about how Independence Day has changed over time? If you're a person of color or an immigrant, what does the 4th of July mean to you? Call in now and tell us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation with historians Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts about their recent piece for The Atlantic, When the 4th of July was a Black Holiday.
And we're looking for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about when you celebrate the 4th of July? Does the holiday have special meaning for you? Do you think it's a day where we should come together to celebrate the country, or do you think it's a day to reflect on where we still have work to do? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Blaine, just before we took our short break, we were talking about the Tullaloos and what a great celebration it was and how the whole African-American community came out for it and what an institution it was. It's more than a little hard to imagine that these kinds of very open, very joyous celebrations were not met with opposition or maybe even violence from the Confederate whites. How were they reacting when they had these celebrations going on right in their midst?
Well, as Ethan suggested earlier, white former Confederates could not really do all of that much in the earliest years of these celebrations, these Black Fourth of Julys in the South. And that's because of Reconstruction and the fact that the Republican Party, which was the progressive party at that point and the ally of former slaves, was in power throughout much of the South during this period. That does change starting in the kind of early to mid 1870s. And so what starts to happen is that you see former Confederates, white conservatives in the region at this point, members of the Democratic Party, actually starting to use 4th of July celebrations as a way to violently reassert their power and try to regain control of the South. And in South Carolina, the best example of that would be something called the Hamburg Massacre. And this was a conflict in Hamburg, South Carolina, over a Black militia parade on July the 4th that year, in which white vigilantes ended up killing 17 African Americans. And so this is an example of how this holiday, white conservatives, white Southerners used it to try to wrest control back from Black Southerners.
And that took place in 1876, which is at the tail end of this reassertion of political power by white conservatives known as redemption. And South Carolina was one of the last three Southern states to be redeemed by white conservatives, along with Louisiana and Florida. And in the aftermath of that, this is when white Southerners start to implement Jim Crow laws and customs, start to segregate the South, start to disenfranchise African-American voters, and eventually they also start to quash these Black celebrations of the 4th. In Charleston, for instance, city leaders pass ordinances aimed at driving Tullaloo out of White Point Garden, that beautiful park that Blaine was discussing a little bit earlier, and eventually out of the city altogether. And by the early 1900s, the Tullaloo and Black Fourths across the South have been largely largely gone.
And Blaine, your book is about who controls how we collectively remember slavery, and this decade-long period of Black Independence Day celebrations seems like a pretty rare moment in history where recently freed slaves, people who had no power politically or culturally, really controlled their own narrative. Did it surprise you that it was possible to have that kind of self-agency so quickly after emancipation?
Yeah, sure. In a sense, it did. This was really a remarkable period in the South when the memory of slavery was controlled by former slaves. In a place like Charleston, in addition to 4th of July parades, they had other celebrations marking the end of slavery. Probably the most famous one would be in March 1865, and it was actually, we call it the Slavery is Dead Parade. They had a parade marking the death of slavery with a hearse carrying a coffin that said slavery is dead on the side. And it was really important, this moment in South Carolina and Charleston history, and really the history of the South in general, that freed slaves could control the memory and insert themselves into these public spaces in a way that they absolutely could not before the Civil War, and that became increasingly difficult as white Southerners regained control of the South. And you don't really see African Americans pushing their own memories of slavery into the public sphere again until the Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s.
And what about the white Southerners? I mean, often it doesn't take very long after even very significant events that collective memory starts to either fade or kind of get rewritten. How were white Southerners depicting slavery and the end of slavery even in the couple decades after the Civil War?
That's a great question. I mean, really, what our book traces is the 150-year battle between the memories of white Southerners, in most cases, and the memories of black Southerners. And we call the two traditions of memory that they develop the whitewashed memory and the unvarnished memory of slavery. And so the whitewashed memory is a tradition that's developed by former slaveholders and their descendants, and they start pushing this narrative immediately after the Civil War, but it takes a while for it to really take hold in the public in a place like Charleston. This is a tradition, the whitewash tradition. It downplays the importance of slavery to the history and to the wealth of Charleston, of South Carolina, of the nation. It downplays the importance of slavery to the coming of the Civil War. The lost cause tradition comes out of the whitewashed memory of slavery. It's also a tradition that argues that slavery wasn't that bad a thing, that it was a benign thing, even a beneficial and civilizing thing, something that helped the enslaved as well as people who owned slaves. So that's the whitewashed memory, and former slaves and their descendants and some white allies push against that and argue that no, that slavery was central, it was brutal, it was violent, and it did cause the Civil War, and that's the unvarnished memory. But for the better part of the last 150 years, it's the whitewashed memory that predominated across the South, and especially in a city like Charleston.
Well, and as we start to wrap up, Blaine, you know, we saw major conflicts over Confederate monuments and whether they should be maintained and preserved or whether they should be taken down. And that was just about a year ago. Did that surprise you that this can be such a very emotional issue for so many people on both sides of the issue?
You know, not really. One of the things that we discovered over the course of our research is how fraught and contested many of these monuments were from the very beginning. And a really good example of that would be the John C. Calhoun Monument that is in downtown Charleston. This was a monument that was erected in the late 18th century and that honors a man who once called, late 19th century, that once called slavery a positive good. And so white Charlestonians venerated him and put up this monument to him, but black Charlestonians, of course, had very different feelings. And they protested that monument from the very beginning.
And we'll have to leave it there. Ethan, thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And Blaine, thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you.
Ethan Keitel and Blaine Roberts are historians and the authors of Denmark Vesey's Garden, Slavery and Memory in the Cradle of the Confederacy.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we start a week-long series on different aspects of immigration in America. First, an introduction to U.S. immigration law.
We look at the struggles that women farmers face in caring for their children and their farm.
And we examine how religious faith influences the emotional life of those who believe.
That's Monday on Central Time.